Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers. But you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car... Use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 33 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, what's going on?
What's up, man?
What's up?
What's up?
We're bringing that back?
Yeah.
What's up?
What's up?
So, Gib, speaking of how we start off the show, I don't know if you saw on social media, but our good friend Caroline started talking about the fact that she thought I was, when I say, you know, I'm Mike Ferguson, I think she kind of sounded like I was getting ready to say like a Beastie Boys line.
Oh yeah.
Did you see that on Twitter?
I didn't.
And then, I'm blanking on the name. Somebody in the Facebook group came back and imposed my face on one of the Beastie Boys. And it said, I'm Mike D and I get respect.
Oh, I remember it.
Did
now.
You see that?
Yeah.
I got a chuckle out of it. I thought it was pretty funny and creative.
You probably could rap a little bit.
I could if I had
Beastie
to.
Beastie Boy rap style.
Yeah. I did back in the day.
Yeah. I believe you probably did.
I had some 10-inch subwoofers in the back of my Grand Am. All right, Gibbs, let's get to some Patreon shout outs. We have Michelle Giacomero, Joe Farrar. Who Joe's been with us for a while, but he actually just jumped up to our highest level, so he gets a special gold star contributor shout out.
He's super social media.
Yeah, Joe's all over, especially the Facebook group, and I love that Facebook group, dude. There's a lot of interaction in there.
They love you.
Shit, everything says hashtag Team Gibby, but that's okay.
Don't be a hater, man.
I'm not a hater.
Don't be hating.
I intentionally pump you up to be the. Yeah. Unsung hero of the show.
Sure. That's it.
That's there what my go. Job is to do. So we have Jen Paradiso, Mary Carmody Trotman, Sean Hake, and Danny Jock.
Danny.
And Danny's been pretty active recently as well. So, and then if we go back into the vault, Gibbs.
You know, every time you do that, I get nervous what vault you're going into. Because if you go in the vault of my house, there's things in there I just don't want to be found.
I have three or four vaults in my house too, but
yeah. So
I don't have the kind of skeletons in my closet or in my vaults that you may or may not have.
We'll leave it at that.
We don't know what they are.
We're just, yeah, let's leave it at that.
I assume one of the vault just has a whole bunch of ankle bracelet monitoring devices. Do they give those back to you when the time is over?
Oh, yeah. You got to return them.
Oh, you don't get to keep them? Oh, because that'd be really cool if you just had them all laid out.
Yeah. Like, you know how people have their jewelry laid out and their shoes.
Yeah, you could actually get one of those watch cases.
Oh, yeah.
And just display them that way.
Get like, which one am I going to wear today?
Because it really just shows, it really shows your arc.
Yeah.
Through your life.
Maybe I could match them up with my knife collection.
Yeah. I don't know what people think about you, man, but I like it.
I guess we'll find out if next time we go to Crime Con.
Yeah. So in the vault, we've chosen to give special recognition to Rebecca Cohen. Rebecca has been a longtime Patreon supporter. And so big, big shout out to Rebecca.
Thanks, Rebecca.
And a big shout out to all the new folks that have decided to support us on Patreon. All the people that continue to support us. And then on top of that, Gibbs, we talk about it a lot, but social media, you know, the sharing of our posts on Facebook, retweets on Twitter, telling your friends at work. I mean, all of that stuff is more helpful than I think people can possibly imagine.
Yeah. Word of mouth, man. Keep it going.
Yeah. We appreciate it. Just want to talk a little bit real quick. If you haven't listened to my two new podcasts, Criminology with Mike Morford and then Sex, Love, and Murder with Aphrodite Jones, give those a chance. They're out there right now on iTunes, Android, all, you know, Stitcher, they're everywhere. And if you haven't listened to it already, True Crime All the Time, episode out right now on Oba Chandler.
Man, I love that co-host on that one.
He's a cool dude.
Yeah, he's really good.
Yeah. The main guy is pretty good too.
Yeah, it's all right.
He doesn't say a lot, but when he does talk, it's outstanding.
Okay.
The nuggets, the pearls of wisdom.
The wisdom.
That come out from the main guy on that show. I mean, you're not going to find that anywhere else.
Besides right here, right now.
I can't remember his name. It's something like Tibbs or Dibbs. So Oba Chandler, Gibbs.
Oba Chandler. Man, what a sick person.
We've done a lot of sick individuals on True Crime All the Time. And by sheer number, this guy doesn't stack up. But by the nastiness, by the unbelievable, unspeakable, I mean, you can use whatever words you want to say, the acts that he committed, when all the details come out, there's some of the worst of the worst. I'll say that. The guy was, he was a piece. Look for the Q&A episode coming out this Wednesday night. It's just Gibby and I sitting down, answering questions that have been posed to us. Informal, probably a little more lighthearted than what a regular episode is. And, you know, we're just going to be ourselves.
I'm going to be somebody different.
Are you?
Yeah.
Male, female?
I don't know.
You're still figuring out. Are you going to wear a costume?
Maybe.
When you come in studio?
I might.
All right. So look for that Wednesday night. All right, Gibbs. We got to get into this case on Unsolved. The murder of Amy Gellert. And this is one that kind of has me mesmerized. Everything we do on Unsolved is a tragic case, right? There's nothing on Unsolved where there's not some unbelievable tragedy. And usually there's a mystery that goes along with it, just given the fact that it's unsolved. You add in the suspects and you add in the investigation and all of that. And this one definitely fits into that category, but it's super mysterious. And I think we're going to see that, you know, as we go along. Now, the one thing about this one is in researching it, I think we quickly found out, Gibbs, there wasn't as much information out there as what we had hoped, what we normally have to call from.
True.
But we'll start with Amy Gellert. She was born February 22nd, 1973 in Cocoa Beach, Florida. And she would live in the Cocoa Beach area for most of her 21 years. And in March of 1994, Amy was living with her mom and her stepfather. And they lived in a nice house in a quiet area. And it was said, Gibbs, that her family was a well-respected family in the area. So I think it's important to point this out that, you know, this was a nice area of town that they lived in. But tragic events would unfold on March 20th, 1994. And This was spring break time in Cocoa Beach, Gibbs. And March 20th was a beautiful day. And we have to talk a little bit about Cocoa Beach. Not a huge city, you know, population of 10, 11, 12,000, something like that.
Okay.
But a destination, I think, for some spring breakers.
Yeah, I mean, Daytona was the big spring break place, but that was only, it's probably like, what, 45 minutes, an hour up from there?
Yeah, so to me, Cocoa Beach would not be on the same level as a Daytona or a Panama City. I mean, that's where I went to spring break back in the day.
Yeah, and we know how you like beaches.
I don't like beaches, but I did go on spring break. But I want to paint the picture a little bit of Cocoa Beach. It's not a Daytona. It's not a Panama City, but it was spring break at this time. And I think that's important as we're setting this up, because in any area that you would consider a spring break destination, what does that do, Gibbs? It brings an influx of people that are not native to the area.
Exactly. Yeah. You're getting all kind of transient people coming in.
Right. They're coming from where we live, right? They're coming from Michigan. They're coming from Ohio.
Pennsylvania, New Jersey.
They're trying to get south to get some warm weather. So I think it's an important aspect of this story. We're not just saying it's spring break just to say it. So March 20th was a Sunday, and Amy would attend church services at the family church that night. Her mom sees her at the church around 7:30 p.m., and is getting ready to leave. And Amy says, "I'll be home soon." That's what she tells her mom. Amy's mom and stepdad, they get home before Amy. And it said, Gibbs, that they arrived a little earlier than normal. So I don't know if church service let out earlier, or if they left a little earlier, or maybe they normally went somewhere after church. But it's important to point out,
they got home before they normally would have, right? So I think you're right. Maybe they just decided not to go grab dinner or coffee or whatever.
Yeah, we don't know the reason why, but we're saying it for a very specific reason, that they arrived home earlier than they normally would, because when they walk in the house that night, they're confronted by a masked intruder. Now, Gibbs, you know that I like to be prepared. And I'm prepared in a whole bunch of different ways, and I won't go into all those ways.
Sure.
But I'd like to think that I'm prepared for most situations. I don't know how prepared I am to walk into my own house and encounter a masked intruder.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine. I mean, if your place is secure, you come in and then you see somebody like that, you know? And then I think about, what if it's your family or one of your kids by themselves that walk into that situation? Scary, man. Really scary.
It is. I'm thinking back to when I come home a lot of times. I'm opening that door assuming that, you know, my house is like the safe place.
Yeah.
You don't expect. Now, I guard against, when I'm home, somebody breaking in.
Right.
But a lot of times I don't have the thought that somebody's going to be in my house laying in wait for me.
And that's a scary thought.
It is. And this is exactly what happens to Amy's stepfather, Robert Layton, and her mother, Charlotte Layton, when they got home that night. As they walk into the house, they see a masked man, and he confronts them holding a large knife and a handgun. The man forced the couple down on their hands and knees and made them crawl into another room and lay on the floor.
And what he did, Mike, was that he made Charlotte lay over the top of Robert. So basically, so like a plus sign in that type of direction. Like her hips was on his hips. If they're both were belly down, that's how he made them lay.
That's strange, Gibbs. I'm just trying to figure out what to make of that.
Yeah, so for us, it would be strange. But someone that has any type of military training or security police training, that's one of the techniques they teach them to subdue multiple persons So if they try to get up at the same time, it makes it very difficult for that person to do that.
You just answered my question then. That makes a lot of sense. But you're also giving some clues that maybe are going to come out down the road, right? Because a lay person is probably not going to have that training, is not going to be that specific in their orders of how to lay.
Exactly right.
You and I would just say, lay down on the ground. I wouldn't be thinking about this plus sign pattern and what type of advantage it would give me because I didn't know about it.
I'd probably be more like Chevy Chase in that one of those vacation movies where he tells the guy, lay down, roll over when they get to the park at the end.
Are you talking about where he has the gun on John Candy?
Yeah, and the other security guard comes out and he tells him, lay on the ground, roll over, like in the Wally World.
All right. Well, You got most of the facts right.
Yeah.
And that is a big step in the right direction.
See, I'm developing.
Of the movie recall of Gibby.
There you go.
I have no idea what it has to do with what we're talking about. No, I'm just kidding. So what the masked man does next is he starts pacing back and forth, almost like he's trying to figure out what to do next. Like he doesn't have a plan and he's trying to figure it out as he goes.
That's kind of scary to me, you know, when somebody's not sure what they want to do.
And we're probably going to talk about it more, but is he unsure about what he's going to do or is he biding time? And I think that's ultimately what's going to be the real question.
Yeah, but to lay there, knowing he has a gun, a big ass knife, I mean, you got to think, what's he going to do? And as a person that thinks, you know, I mean, I consider myself to have some form of self-defense, that I would want to be able to think, what do I need to do when he does whatever he's getting ready to do?
Well, and Robert may have been thinking that too, but he's got his wife laying on top of him. So his options at this point, like you talked about, strategically are very limited in what he's going to be able to do. But I agree with you, Gibbs. Imagine laying there, your face down. You can't see everything that's going on. All you know is that a bad guy with multiple weapons is pacing back and forth, and you don't know what the hell's going on. But as they're laying on the ground, they see headlights shine into the house as a car pulled up in the driveway. And I think their initial thought, Gibbs, is that this is someone that has come to pick up this masked man, you know, because this is either a robbery, they're going to take some stuff from them and leave. But that's not what it turns out to be. This turns out to be Amy coming home from church, pulling in the driveway, and Robert and Charlotte, or Bunny, she went by Bunny, they would later say that as soon as the masked man saw the headlights, he started to freak out. And I'm sure at that point, they realized their initial thought was not correct, right? This is not somebody that has come to pick him up. And I'm not even sure, Gibbs, that freak out is the right word, because he essentially loses it. He goes ballistic. I mean, there's a bunch of different words you can use, but he quickly goes over to Charlotte, slices her neck, stabs her neck as well, to the point where she would later say she could hear her own bones crunching from the vicious knife attack. And then because she's laying face down, he stabs her directly in her lower back. So this was a very brutal, vicious attack on Charlotte. After this, he stabs Amy's stepfather, Robert, in the back of the head. In the back of the head, Gibbs.
Forcefully.
Very hard with a very large knife. I mean, this is an image that it's not going over well with me. It's hard to imagine just how vicious this actually was. So at this point, there's a scramble, right? They're no longer just laying there letting this man attack them. They're trying to get away. Robert is able to get to the front door, open the front door, and scream for help. He actually makes it outside all the way to the driveway where Amy's car is, and he's now screaming for help out there. But the masked man has followed him outside, and at this point, Amy has gotten out of her car. She's standing beside it, and the masked man sees her, and he immediately starts attacking Amy, and she puts up a hell of a fight, Gibbs, because she's going to end up with slash marks on her arms, on her backpack. But she was attacked and stabbed, but was able to run across the street to this apartment complex where she falls down in the parking lot. And this is where she would die, Gibbs.
It's sad.
Well, it is, because she had the strength to run away. But obviously the wounds that she suffered were so serious that, you know, she succumbed to them fairly quickly. You know, she just made it across the street and basically collapses and dies.
As I'm laying on the floor, he's telling me, and this is a quote, "I don't want you to see my face. That would be bad. So keep your back and keep your head pointing this direction." You know, I'm a burglar, and burglars like breaking in people's houses. And how I got in, and he almost seemed to be proud of the fact, is you left one of your doors open. You really shouldn't do that.
During this conversation, how's he acting? I mean,
his voice is, I have to say, it's a little, maybe a bit higher than a normal male voice. He is acting very, very nice to us, very sweet to us, and telling us throughout this process, if we do what he says, you know, he doesn't want to hurt us. He just wanted our money at that point.
Okay.
Very, very nice.
You remember his quotes are exactly when he tells you, I mean, how does he want your money? Does he say, "Give me all your money," using profanity, or just...
No profanity was used at all that I can recall. All he asked was, "What money do you have?" I said, "The only money I have is like $50 or $60 in my pocket." And he asked me to give that to him, and I gave it to him.
Okay.
He asked my wife for her money, and that was the only part mentioned through the whole ordeal for the next 25 or 30 minutes. Anything about, anything more about money.
So Gibbs, this is a clip of Robert being interviewed by detectives in the house sometime after the attack. And it had to have been sometime after, because Robert and Charlotte suffered serious wounds.
I mean, they would need medical treatment right away.
Yeah, I think they were in the hospital for some period of time.
Yeah.
But after they get out, detectives are interviewing Robert, and this is what he tells them. And I think there's some very interesting things that come out of this interview. You know, one of the things is that he said this lasted, 20, 25 minutes. And in the beginning, this masked man or masked intruder or whatever you want to call it was very nice to the couple. You know, he wasn't yelling at them. He wasn't swearing at them. So there probably wasn't a lot to be, I don't want to say concerned with. You're going to be concerned that you're being robbed. But I don't know that Robert and Charlotte were thinking that they had a major reason to be in fear for their life.
I agree with you. Yeah. I think they were just more thinking, when is this going to be over and he's going to leave.
Right. If we comply, if we give him what money we have and let him take whatever, VCR, DVD, whatever we have,
right,
we'll be okay.
And I think that's what you're exactly right. I think they were thinking that somebody was going to come pick him up or whatever, and they would load the TV equipment, whatever. I mean, even Charlotte had about $8,000 worth of jewelry in the bedroom.
Yeah, and we talked about what type of neighborhood this was, Gibbs. This would be a target for a robber, a burglar. So I just think it's important to talk about what their mindset might have been like and why they may not have thought that at that point in time, they needed to do something drastic. Now, that all changed the minute that Amy pulled in the driveway, because the actions of the intruder changed dramatically. And right now, we don't know why that was. Why was it that the fact that he saw somebody pull in the driveway caused him to start attacking? But let's talk a little bit about the weapons that this guy used during the attack. because Amy's mom and stepfather would later say that the guy was holding a dagger. A dagger, Gibbs.
That's one way to describe just a big-ass knife, really.
It is, but they were very specific in describing this dagger slash knife and the fact that it had a very ornate hilt, right? So the part that keeps your hand from sliding up onto the blade, that's the hilt.
Yeah, because they couldn't see the handle. I know that's not the real word that people use in knife world.
Are you just giving away the fact that you're not a knife expert?
I'm a K-bar, buddy.
After months and months of proclaiming your knife expertise?
Yeah, I don't even know K-bars, man.
But they were very specific, Gibbs.
They were.
So they called it a dagger, you know, a knife, whatever you want to call it. But the fact that it was ornate, that means something.
So what they would say is that the hilt would look like a gold chain twisted together.
But police are never able to find this dagger. And the man was also armed with a gun. We talked about that. But police are able to determine that this gun wasn't real. It was a prop gun made by a company called Brixia. And the reason they were able to determine this is because the assailant somehow dropped the magazine before fleeing the scene. And they were able to tie this back to the fact that it was this prop gun. And basically, these Brixia guns, they fire blanks and they're used to in movies and TV shows and those type of things, but they're not lethal. So Gibbs, we've talked about the weapons used in this attack. Let's talk a little bit more.
I'm an Italian today. Okay. A little bit more.
Let's talk a little bit more about the actual assailant. We talked about wearing a mask. He was dressed in black, wore gloves. So we're talking black pants, black top, black gloves, and a black ski mask. But for some reason, Gibbs was wearing white tennis shoes.
Fashion statement?
Strikes me as very odd.
Yeah.
Not very hard to find black shoes to complete the ensemble.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a fashionista.
No doubt about that.
But I know enough that if you're dressed all in black, a white pair of tennis shoes is going to stand out. I just don't get the thinking behind it. Is it important? I don't know. I think in a case like this, some of the things that you think are the smallest details can sometimes turn out to be unbelievably important. Now, I don't know the fact that he wore white tennis shoes would be that, but I think it's important for us to talk about everything.
So what catches my eye is that black leather gloves and a ski mask, that's something that you wouldn't typically find in Florida. You know, this is a warm weather state. What do you need black leather gloves and a ski mask for?
Yeah, I'm sure you can buy them, but you're right. I mean, these are things that you would normally associate with the northern states where it gets cold, especially a ski mask. I don't know when anybody in Florida would ever need a ski mask. It rarely snows. And, you know, even in December, January, now it'll get cold, but I don't know, not to the point where you need a full-blown ski mask, I wouldn't think.
Right.
So I think you have that aspect of it, wearing certain items that you would expect to normally find in a northern state. And that kind of comes back to what you and I were talking about. It's spring break. Is that a factor? But again, if somebody's going on spring break down to Florida, they're not packing a ski mask. So I might have just probably double-crossed myself there. But
well, unless you're moving from a northern state to Florida and just bringing everything you have with you.
Maybe. But I think probably the more interesting point to make is why wear a ski mask? And I think you could talk about that from a couple of different points of view. Number one, you wear one to conceal your identity. So does that mean that the thought was he was there to rob? He wasn't there to murder?
Well, yeah, because if you were going to murder, why do you even care if you have a ski mask on? Because there was going to be no witnesses.
Right.
But if you were going to rob and you knew the people, or you thought they might know who you are, that's the only reason to put a mask on.
And the only other angle I'll talk about is, and we're going to get into it a lot more, but who was the intended target? And did he need a ski mask because he wasn't planning on killing everybody in that house? Now, some facts about this man would come out from Robert and Charlotte. And Robert would say that pretty early on in the confrontation, he could tell that the man underneath this mask was Caucasian. You know, he could see around the eye holes enough to know that the skin color indicated that this man was Caucasian. The other thing that they thought was that this was a young guy, most likely in his 20s. And I think, Gibbs, they were basing that a lot on the way that this individual talked. You know, you can tell a lot by somebody's voice, their speech pattern, the specific types of words they say. Now, it's not always foolproof, but that's what they were basing their opinion on. And Amy's mom, Charlotte, she actually thought he had a very specific dialect. And she even thought she could pinpoint it, Gibbs, down to a few different states. You know, she thought it sounded like maybe a Pennsylvania, Maryland, that type of East Coast, but not New England type East Coast, more middle of the country East Coast is what I think she was thinking.
Yes.
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 And the other thing that they told police, Gibbs, and it goes back to something you said, which was that they had a very strong opinion that this individual had some type of military experience. You know, some of that came from what you talked about, having Charlotte lay across Robert in a very specific way. But the other part of it came from, you know, more of a general attitude. How this person acted, how he talked, how he controlled the room, I think maybe that might have had played a part.
And I think you can go a little deeper with his ability to use his knife. I mean, you know, when you are in the military, certain branches, they will have knife fighting skills that they teach you.
Yeah, like close quarter combat.
Yep.
That involves knife fighting, yeah.
So, you know, it's important to know how to use your knives.
Or knives. But it's not normally done with an ornate dagger.
No, not typically. Normally one sharp edge is good enough.
Yeah, but the skills would translate.
It would.
If you learn those type of close quarter combat knife fighting skills, that would definitely translate to any type of handheld weapon. So now we get into some DNA talk, Gibbs, because police found DNA on the Guns magazine, which we said was left behind. But we also said that this man was wearing gloves. And I think there's a couple different ways to look at this as well. You can look at it as, was this really from the intruder? Or could somebody possibly have handled it? But again, I think if it was family members, police, they would be able to rule them out pretty quickly. My thought, Gibbs, is that so he wore gloves in the commission of the crime, but most likely he would not have loaded this magazine while wearing gloves. You know, this is something that he most likely would have done at home, planning this attack or, you know, putting everything together. He may not have thought, hey, I need to wear gloves. I'm at my house or wherever. Does that make sense?
It does.
But the problem is they have this DNA, but they've not been able to match it. So that means to me, Gibbs, that this guy's not in a database, which probably means he was not military. And we really have to talk about the motive in this case, Gibbs, because ultimately I think a lot of this is going to tie to motive. And in the beginning, investigators looked at the mom and the stepfather as if they were probably the targets And Amy just happened to come home, and because of that, she was killed. But there's a couple of things that make that theory quite not as plausible. Number one, this guy could have stolen a lot of expensive items from the home, but he didn't. Number two, he could have taken more cash than he did, but he took a very small amount and a few credit cards. I mean, you talked about a pretty valuable jewelry collection that Amy's mom, Charlotte, had in the house. So a lot of that kind of goes to the fact of, was this really a robbery? Was he really after or targeting Betty and Robert?
Well, and even the police kind of think about, you know, what Charlotte and Robert did for a living, right? They were therapists, psychologists. Could have this been one of their disgruntled type of patient?
So I think that probably led to a lot of the initial speculation, because as therapists, I'm assuming that they were in contact with all types of different people, many people with some form or another of mental illness. So that had to be going through the investigators' minds, thinking, was it one of these patients that was upset with one or the other, and this is what led to the attack? But Gibbs, there were some other investigators that thought the real target was Amy. You know, Amy was 21 years old at the time of her death. She was working as a sound engineer for a recording studio. As we mentioned, she was living at home with her mom and stepdad at the time. And some things about Amy: very passionate about music. She actually got a job at the family church where they all attended. And this was where she was working as a sound engineer. It was called the Calvary Chapels Recording Studio. Amy's mom and dad divorced when she was 3 years old. And then at the age of five, Amy became ill with encephalitis. And this left her with some learning disabilities. But everyone around her, Gibbs, that knew her, had ever known her, had ever interacted with her, said that there was no nicer person on the planet than Amy Geller. The other thing that people said about her was that she was not what you would call a girly girl.
She was a pretty girl, but she wasn't the type of girl that would, it was all princess and she'd be okay getting dirty out there.
Yeah, I just think that she was into a lot of things. Probably not at the top of her list, though, was, you know, wearing dresses and those type of things. I don't know if she was a tomboy per se.
I just think she liked hanging with the guys, you know? There's people I know, that gals I know, that they'd rather hang out with the guys than a bunch of girls. That's just what they'd rather do.
Now, unfortunately, like a lot of people, like a lot of kids back in that time, and even today, Gibbs, Amy did dabble into some drugs. She was into smoking pot, and it did get so bad at one point that her mom had to send her to a rehab program, and it was called Straight. But in 1992, Amy returned home from this rehab program as what everybody around her said was basically a completely different person, a new and better person even. I mean, she was a great person before that, but now she was off the drugs. She started to hang out with a lot of people from the church. She really kind of turned her life around through going to this rehab program. But all this being said, the police investigation, the evidence collected, the theories, all of that, Gibbs, none of it leads to any arrests, and there's no developments in the case for about 20 years. 20 years, Gibbs, goes by with basically nothing happening. I don't want to say nothing, but nothing substantial.
Yeah, because it's kind of idle.
Yeah, so it gets very cold.
Yeah.
Becomes a cold case.
I mean, they had suspects back then, but nothing that developed, right? Nothing that came about.
And Gibbs, let's talk about some of the suspects in this case. Some developed earlier on, some developed much later, And the first one I think we have to talk about is a man by the name of Jeffrey Anderson. And Jeffrey Anderson was convicted of burglary and sent to prison for those offenses. So there's a tie-in there, Gibbs. And then you have to talk about the fact that Anderson was involved in a police chase the day after Amy was murdered. And when police finally caught up with him, he was in a stolen car. And later on, some of Charlotte's credit cards were found on the side of the road near the place that police caught up with him. So there's another tie-in right there. Those two things alone caused him to be on police radar. Now, there were a couple things in his favor, though, because he did take and pass a polygraph, and he also passed a voice lineup. So, Gibbs, this would have been where Robert and Charlotte would have had a chance, anonymously, I assume, to hear this person speak, and they must have concluded that he didn't sound like the person that they encountered that day. And the next person we want to talk about is a man by the name of Hugh Popple. Now, he had a previous romantic relationship with Amy, but Popple didn't hit police radar until 2013. And this was over 19 years after the crime occurred. And the only reason that he even hit police radar was because a tip came into the crime line. Now, at the time this tip came into the crime line, Popple had already been killed in a hit and run. But what the caller was saying was that his death was karma for what he had done to Amy. So somebody called the crime line and tried to pin this on Hugh Popple. But Gibbs, there was no physical evidence to link him with Amy's murder. So this one's just really strange to me. It's basically, you know, somebody pointing the finger at him after he was killed. I mean, he couldn't defend himself.
No.
So it's something to bring up, but I just don't know how much, you know, credence that, you know, to even put into it.
Yeah, I don't think you can put too much into it.
But Gibbs, now we get into the main suspects in this case. And the first one to talk about is Dominic Canuca. And back when Amy was killed, Dominic was 22 years old, working in a kitchen as a cook. He had recently moved from Pennsylvania to Cocoa Beach and moved in with his high school girlfriend. The police were tipped off about Dominic a year after Amy's murder when someone heard his girlfriend say that he had something to do with the murder. As police looked into it, they found out that the day after the murder, he also stole a car. Very strange, Gibbs. We got people stealing cars all over the place, and they just happened to be the day after Amy Gellert's murder.
It's a little strange.
It's very strange. But apparently, he stole this car to get out of town, and he headed back to Pittsburgh. Investigators are ultimately going to track him down, and when they're questioning Dominic, he admits to them that he was at the scene of the crime, but only because he was on his way home from work. And when he saw all the flashing lights, he got out to see if he could help the police. So Gibbs, I say scene of the crime, but he's basically placing himself there well after the attacks and the murder, after police have already come on scene.
Right. And he actually says that he stopped and he was helping a police officer hang the crime scene tape, which I find that kind of hard to believe that a police officer would allow a bystander
to assist in that. I was going to say that too. That doesn't seem like something that police officers would outsource to Joe Public.
Yeah. And I think the investigators are kind of wrinkling their nose at it as well. Like, I'm not sure a police officer would do that.
It's not passing the smell test to them.
Yeah.
So because it's not passing all their tests, Gibbs, they investigate further and they find out that Dominic didn't actually go to work that night.
So boom, big hole in his story now.
Yeah. And that's how you get put on the main list of suspects, right? If you're telling investigators things that they find out later not to be true, they're going to start looking at you.
And so the other thing is, we know he just moved from Pennsylvania fairly recently. So did he bring his winter gear from Pennsylvania down to him when he moved in with his girlfriend at Cocoa Beach? I'm guessing, yeah.
Well, you have that, but you also have the fact that he matches what Robert and Charlotte, or Charlotte specifically said, that, you know, she thought the accent was from possibly Pennsylvania.
That's true. You got that as well.
So big couple of tie-ins there. Nothing concrete.
Yeah.
But a couple of things that kind of maybe point in his direction. Now, he also took a polygraph, but unlike Anderson, he failed. But for some reason, Gibbs, they never put Dominic Kanuka through the same voice lineup as they did Anderson.
I find that difficult to understand why.
Yeah, because if Charlotte or Robert was able to hear that voice and they said, oh my gosh, that is without a doubt the person.
Case over.
That would change things greatly. So they have a failed polygraph. They have some inconsistencies with his story. So it seems like a good lead, but there's no hard evidence. There's no witness that put him at the scene of the murder. There's no physical evidence that ties him to being there. But the police don't give up on investigating him. I mean, he remains on the radar. And even in 2014, they're still trying to retrace some of his steps. And they go back and they talk to his former girlfriend. And she has some very interesting things to say about him. Pretty much that he was a nice guy 1 minute, but he could flip a switch and become not so nice in a hurry. The other thing that she said, Gibbs, which has to have some alarm bells going off, not for you, but was the fact that he liked to carry knives and he had a lot of them. Now, I like to carry knives too.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
For personal protection.
Oops, yeah.
I also have a lot of them. So make of that what you will. But I'm also not lying to investigators. I'm also not putting myself on the scene. And, you know, these other things.
Well, and step back just a bit, and she says that on a flip of a switch, he goes from nice to not so nice. Well, go back to that night. The guy was a gentleman, if you want to call him a gentleman, while he was trying to rob him. But then all of a sudden, a flip of a switch, he turns into this nightmare of a person stabbing them.
Yeah.
So...
No, I mean, I think you have to look at it all.
Things kind of line up.
Yeah. See what fits and what doesn't fit. He did have some convictions for theft. And the other thing that investigators found out was that he did have some military training. You know, he was in the Marines in boot camp. And this kind of goes back to what you talked about, Gibbs. Did he learn some close quarter combat fighting skills, especially with a knife? And also, is this possibly where he could have learned the tactic of, you know, having one person lay over the other in the form that Robert and Charlotte were asked to lay, because that's the best way to detain multiple people at the same time. But other than that, his former girlfriend, she doesn't throw out any bombshells, right? There's no super evidence that comes out that would lead police to his doorstep. Although he didn't really have a doorstep, Gibbs, I guess, because at the time that they were investigating him in 2014, he was in prison serving time for drug possession and robbing a pharmacy. Now, he said he had no involvement in the murder, but it was also said that he was extremely cocky with investigators during their interview with him, but he didn't really deviate from the stories that he had told them earlier, even though some of them they already knew couldn't be true. So at this point, Gibbs, as it relates to Dominic Kanuka, investigators are thinking that there was a good chance he played some type of role in the attack and in the murder of Amy. And at the same time, they're trying to connect him to their other main suspect in this case, which is Scott Manley. Now, Scott Manley was a very good friend of Amy's, and he was identified as a suspect very early on. I mean, we're talking about within hours of her murder. And there's some reasons for that, Gibbs. It was said that he had keys to the house where Amy lived with her mom and stepfather. On March 20th, Scott was supposed to stop at Amy's house because they were going to go out. But Scott doesn't stop by the house. Instead, he calls and he leaves a voicemail around 9:30 saying that he thought it was too late to go out, but that he would call Amy later. Now, the timing of this, Gibbs, we have to talk about, because investigators know that this voicemail was left about 30 minutes after Amy had been stabbed. So you would think they would automatically be somewhat suspicious of that, wondering, is that a good way for somebody to try to establish an alibi? You know, there's no way it could have been me. I called.
Yeah, you got my voice. Did you not hear my voice on the machine?
Right.
Yeah, couldn't have been me.
But we know it was 30 minutes after.
Right.
It could have been him very easily. And Scott had a lot of things going against him in the way of personality characteristics. You know, he was known as a con artist type of person, the bad boy. He was described as a good looking guy. I think women liked him. He had no problems
with the ladies.
Well, let's put it that way. But Scott was also a drug addict. And it was actually in rehab where he and Amy met. But he was much more into it than I think Amy ever was, Gibbs. Would you say that?
I would say that.
Because in the research, it talked about the fact that he had been to a lot of different rehab clinics. And not just in Florida. I mean, we're talking about New Jersey, Pennsylvania. And again, when we're talking about tie-ins and you talk about accents or dialects, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, you know, it's something to think about. And people close to Amy would say that Scott actually got Amy back into smoking pot again after she'd gotten clean from the rehab.
And just days before she was murdered, she had her brother run her over to Scott's apartment to pick up a package. But again, nobody knows what that package was. It was said a lot that her and Scott would pool their money together to buy X amount of ounces of marijuana. So I think we could assume maybe she was picking up her portion of the buy.
And I mean, whether she was doing drugs or they were doing drugs together, to me, I don't know how big of a deal that is, Gibbs. What I do think is a big deal is money and whether or not Scott may have owed Amy some money, because that's where you can really get into talking about a possible motive. And there were some people that would claim that they thought that was true, that Scott owed Amy some amount of money.
Yeah.
And we know what money does to people. It can often be a motive for murder.
So the weird thing is that the day after the murder, Scott actually goes to police headquarters and tells them, hey, I left her a voicemail that her and I could not meet up that night. That's a weird thing to go and tell the police, right? I mean, the police haven't come to you yet. Why are you going there in the morning to make sure that they, hey man, did you hear that little thing I left on the voicemail, that tape? Did you hear it? Because I want to make sure you did.
Well, I think it's very strange because you know the police are going to listen to voicemails as part of their investigation. You going to point it out, you might as well just have a spotlight shining on the top of your head as you walk in.
Yeah.
Because it makes no sense.
No. It's
because in my opinion, Gibbs, if the voicemail was innocent, why point it out? But if you left it for a very specific reason, as in to say, there's no way I could have killed her, because I left a voicemail, which doesn't prove anything, but that's the reason why you would want to point it out, right? You want to make sure investigators know that you tried to contact her because you think it's going to mean something.
Yeah, and I think the other weird part is that he voluntarily, you know, he says, look, I stopped by the house earlier that evening as well to drop off $30 I owed her. Again, I just don't understand why would you go to the police department to just throw that out there?
But that's not the end of that story, though. There's more to this $30 story. Because number one, he says his dad drove him to the house, which is very odd. These are not 14-year-old people. These are people in their 20s. He also said that his dad gave him the $30 to give to Amy. So you're talking about a 20-some-year-old kid that doesn't even have $30.
Right.
Doesn't have a car. He's not on the right path in the game of life.
He might be good looking, but that's about it, it sounds like.
But to top it off, he later says that he never actually gave the money to Amy. He put it in his pocket to keep it for himself.
So he was just scamming the money from his dad. Hey, Dad, I owe Amy $30. Can you run me over? Acts like he goes up the door, puts it in his pocket, and comes back, and he's got $30 so he can go buy his next fix.
Right. So this was a scam that he was running on his dad. There's one other issue that conflicts with the story that Scott tells, and it's that another friend comes forward claiming that they had plans to go to the beach that night with Amy. So how does she have plans with two different people to do two different things? You know, that's a mystery that I don't think has been solved either. But one easy explanation is that she never had plans with Scott at all. But we have to talk about Scott's alibi because he says he was home by 9 p.m.
And he lived with his parents.
And they back it up.
They back it up.
No physical evidence was found linking him to the crime scene. So again, Gibbs, you know, you look at all these suspects and you think, oh man, that really doesn't look good. And this doesn't look good. But at the end of the day, especially in the case of Scott, if his parents are telling the truth, which, you know, no way to know for sure.
Right.
But if they are, then he's got a pretty good alibi. Because we know that Amy was murdered around 9 p.m. So if he's at his house before then and then makes the call at 9:30, you know, that's somewhat solid. But again, it all hinges on whether people are telling the truth. But Scott does get in trouble in 1995 because he does a stint in rehab in Colorado. And this guy's all over the country just rehabbing it up in multiple states. But after this stint in rehab, he was accused of kidnapping his girlfriend's child. So at one point, Gibbs, the police go visit him in jail as well. I mean, is this a coincidence that all these people end up in jail? Or is this just
sounds like a bad group of individuals.
It really does.
Theft, drugs, prison.
So while they're talking to him in the jail, when they start to question Scott about Amy, it's said that he gets very upset, very defensive, and comes out and says that he would have never hurt Amy. He also takes a polygraph, but fails. And at some point, he gets out of jail because in 2005, he gets arrested again, this time for robbery back in Florida. But we talked about police trying to tie Scott and Dominic together. And this is the reason for that statement, is because on the night that Amy was killed, allegedly Scott was driving around looking to buy some crack from a man known only as Nick. So the question is, was this Dominic? There are a lot of people within the police that feel that the two somehow work together so Scott could get his drugs and Dominic would get access to the house to steal their valuables.
So kind of like payment for, so give me the drugs for my fix. I can get you into this house because I have the key access, right?
Yeah, working together to get what they both want.
Yeah.
But Scott and Dominic both tell the police they don't even know who the other one is. But someone comes forward, Gibbs, to say that Scott actually interviewed at the same restaurant that Dominic worked at And there was a waitress who identified Scott as coming into the restaurant asking for Dominic specifically. So especially that last one, if that one's true, it kind of blows a hole in that first statement that, hey, we don't even know each other.
Exactly.
But the investigators have problems because Scott and Dominic are in prison on unrelated crimes. Neither has been charged in connection with Amy's death. And the problems that they have, a lot of them center around that DNA we talked about that came from the magazine that was left at the scene. The DNA doesn't match Scott Manley, doesn't match Dominic Canuca, and for that matter, Gibbs, it doesn't match any other suspect known to police. So my question on that one is the DNA that came from that gun magazine even related to the killer at all?
Yeah, it might not be. Maybe one day we'll hit the database and something will pop up and maybe we'll hear more about it.
Yeah, I think that's where, you know, you get so tied in with this DNA sometimes. Maybe it was left by...
Could be any. My DNA's everywhere.
Yeah, somebody totally unrelated to any of this. And it really was one of these people that did it, but they're being excluded because of the DNA.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, investigators have come out and said that Amy's killer could most likely be somebody that has never been on their radar.
Could have been one of those spring breakers.
They don't know anything about. And the sad part is they may never know.
Yeah, that's true. Disappointing.
Yeah, it really is because, you know, you talk about the circumstances around a case and all the evidence and all the work that investigators put in talking to people and, you know, trying to piece it all together. And then you get 20 some years down the road. And what do you have? Are they any further to catching somebody? Probably not. And that's pretty sad when you think about how many man hours and how much taxpayer money has gone into this. I'm not saying the police have done a bad job at this at all.
No, but there's always going to be some form of limitations
yeah.
in your investigation.
There's only so much you can do. There's only so much you have to work with. Sometimes, and you and I do a lot of solve cases on our other podcast, it comes down to a lucky break, you know, a tip, somebody coming forward, somebody overhearing something else. And there's a lot of cases that are solved that way.
Yeah. So if you know something, it's time to speak up.
Yep, it really is. All right, Gibbs, before we go, let's play a voicemail.
Mike and the Tipster, what's up, guys? This is Trevor from up in Portland, Oregon. Just wanted to say thank you for all your hard work and effort you put into the show. Definitely my favorite podcast. I get so involved into the podcast, and I get so into it that I work overnight in a store by myself. I have to keep looking over my shoulder to make sure, you know, BTK or Israel Keys isn't right behind me with an axe. So I just want to say thanks for all you guys do and, you know, keep your own time a ticking.
All right, Trevor, thanks a lot for the voicemail.
Keep that head on a swivel.
Yep, always. I still don't know what he called you, Gibbs. I thought at first it was Gibster, then it sounded like Tootster.
Oh, no, I got a lot of nicknames out there.
Yeah, it could have just been garbled maybe from the phone or the recording software, but...
Let me know what your favorite nickname is for Gibby.
Yeah, Trevor, send us an email. Gotta know what you called Gibby. I've listened to that voicemail like 5 times. I can't figure it out. All right, well, that is another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike...
And Gibby.
Stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming, like when your favorite podcast is playing and the person next to you is talking and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their nifty comparison tool a try and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you need is easy. All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverages you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies all lined up and ready to compare, so it's simple to choose the rate and coverages you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.